From KLCC Media, this is the Oregon Grapevine. I'm Barbara Dellenbach. The Oregon Grapevine highlights fresh-pressed conversations with people who are actively and passionately creating the present and future in which they wish to live. Aisha Elliott is a diversity, equity, and inclusion educator, the founder of the community benefit organization Kids for the Culture, and podcast host, Black Girl from Eugene. Thank you, Aisha, for being here and for joining us on the Oregon Grapevine. I appreciate your time, and thank you for the work you're doing. May we start, if we could, with just kind of your personal story. I'd like to know why you have arrived where you are in your life and why this work is important to you. Why are you doing what you're doing?
Well, how many days do we have? No, I'm just kidding. Thank you for having me on your show. What has brought me to this work and what has brought me to Black Girl from Eugene is really my lived experience being born in Eugene, growing up in Eugene until I was 15, having two very, very Black, very revolutionary parents, and living in a very contrasted reality of a very white world of Eugene, Oregon. And I left at 15. I traveled and lived in lots of different cultures and places and moved back. I have three children of my own. Everything is okay, you know, when you're here in this bubble. And as you leave and come back, then you have context. Different context from your parents telling you what it was and what it is. You have this lived context. So in 2015, you know, I have, like I said before, three children. And in 2015, my oldest son and I were attacked by a Eugene Police Department under an unfortunate series of events that led me to being beat up and my son being tased and arrested. I was arrested. Lawsuit happened. It took me about 2.5 years to recover physically. I'd say 3 years out of my concussion mentally. So it was a whole about 4 years of recovery from an incident with the Eugene Police Department in my front yard. And we lost the case because the jury was like, it was quoted to say, I just couldn't imagine that the police officer would do that, even though I really feel empathy for her. So that sparked a reality for me that even though I'm from Eugene, even though I've worked in lots of areas of Eugene that are very community-based, I've worked for the, you know, as a coach, I am a student at the U of O, I've worked for in the healthcare system there, I've also worked, you know, for the state of Oregon there, my children are all, you know, top performing athletes and great grades, and my whole family, my brother, you know, jazz musician. We just have this huge, rich legacy in Eugene. And to be treated with such disrespect and disregard by someone or people that I actually took time in that incident to try to de-escalate the situation myself, and I tried to approach as if I was being helped, and then quickly understood that I was not going to be helped. It was one of those things that just gave me this quick reality check. And I want to say quick because in that moment, as soon as I was, you know, in jail thinking about what had just happened, I just, the value of who I was all in question in terms of my proximity to whiteness. Not that it had been not clear before, but if it ever was any questions that I could be seen as a valued Black woman in Eugene, Oregon, that answered it for me. So it took all of my education, all of my years of experience, all my multiculturalism point of view and perspective to decide that I need to wrap that all up in my education as an educator and teach back to what people really aren't understanding about what it means to interact and to have true intent, your attention truly lined up to your impact, and understand that cognitive dissonance of race does impact people of color in really, really, really life-changing ways. And so I know that's a long story, but that is how I got to doing what I'm doing. It really was a journey of my experience all the way through the proximity of whiteness, compromise, vulnerability, and then really coming into my truth after a really painful incident and some years of recovery. And here I am.
Wow. So how do you take that experience and in light, and we won't even go right now into kind of international stories of colonialism, but in terms of just what's going on with Black Lives Matter, what's going on with very well-meaning people who, for instance, I'm a senior citizen white woman in Eugene who tries hard and other people are like me. How do you take your experience and teach either people like me who are actually trying or perhaps people who are don't really understand really experientially and intellectually at all and get us to not just understand it in our heads, but make change?
Well, I want to start off with saying it's really important as a Black woman and a person of color in any description that we are healed from the trauma of white supremacy before we try to teach white people how to see the cognitive dissonance. I think it's really important that we are healed first. So because it's painful for everyone involved, white supremacist culture doesn't just affect white people. Black and brown people are deconstructing the effects of white supremacy as well, just differently. And white people are absolutely are attempting to deconstruct white supremacy and have other issues to deal with that allow them to do that in a complete way. But if you're looking for someone, an educator, to take you through that, yeah, I think it's important as I'm talking to my fellow colleagues that we are actually whole and healed because this work is tiresome. This work does can create triggers for people who are not healed. This work comes with lots of people who are believing that they're ready to do the work and are absolutely not willing to get uncomfortable. So in my education series and the things that I do, my whole intention of all of the work that I do is to align intention to impact. So that doesn't necessarily, I mean, it's very about mind and heart space around understanding what race is. Now, it doesn't mean that I'm just talking about, like, you know, the woo-woo, how you feel and all that. Really what I do is break it down very slowly to give our present day more context. I actually do really witness. I witness white people actually not knowing. And when you live in a place like Eugene or you live in a place like Oregon, when in the Constitution it was, you know, written that Black people will not live in the main parts of the state, it's an actually built up whitetopia. So it's not at all unreasonable to believe that the privilege is so deep that that folks actually don't see what we're talking about. So because I've lived here for so long, I actually understand what part of it that they are missing. So basically, I'm able to take that information, take the context of the whiteness, the real stark white, Eurocentric-centered Oregon, hippie, you know, we've got the hippies and the yuppies, and I understand all of those contexts under with the lack of diversity there, and try to let people understand and walk with me through the context of racism. We actually start with, you know, what does it mean to you to hear white supremacist culture? What does that mean? And most people go straight to, you know, other people's issues. They go straight to, like, oh, the KKK, QAnon, and then I have to bring it back and say, okay, let's discuss white supremacy in the terms of the acceptance of my hair when I get a job interview. When if in the United States we're having to pass legal legislation that you cannot discriminate against Afro-textured hair, right, in order to say that what's professional and what's not professional, that Eurocentric standard of beauty or acceptance of professionalism, that itself is white supremacy. And usually when I break it down really, really slowly and I kind of like go through everyday motions of how racism shows up in your everyday, people, like, light bulbs just pop off. They're just like, oh, wait a minute. So you're telling me when I go to the store and I'm saying this and this and this and I'm believing that this was like a norm, that in itself, because that's actually not normal for the rest of the whole entire world, like this in itself is the evidence of white supremacy. And I'm saying, yes, there's lots of doors that open up to understanding. But at the same time, that immediately gives a place of discomfort because they start to realize just how much privilege and actual dissonance they have been working from. Some people lean right into it. Some people run directly from it. And really, it's not my job to convince anybody that they are or are not racist. It's a journey in understanding how you show up in the world. And so it's about not about individualism. It's about a collective impact. So that's kind of what I talk about. It's more about like our relationship to racism and what you understand about it so that you can move through the world being more cognitive of your privilege and how it affects other people and how you could choose to do better with it.
Who are you giving these workshops or classes, or who is asking for your help, and who are you aiding in this process?
Everybody. And when I say everybody, I mean literally everybody. I've created a program called Nurturing Black, which is designed to help guide white families who are raising black children and biracial children who identify as black or who's phenotypically different from their family. I also have other families and clients that I work that have older children in Nurturing Black that are from 8 to 13. I also do these consultations with schools. I have a regular consultation with high schoolers in the charter system. I work with businesses, and I work with corporations, and I've just recently done a couple different lectures in Oregon at the state level. Generally, it's, I'd like to start off with the leadership of whoever I'm working with and then go down through staff to try to help people open up their mind about systematic changes and systemic changes that need to happen in order to actually create inclusive spaces. Because my goal, like I said, intention and impact. So my goal is to reach people who have the intention, the good intention of creating inclusive spaces. And when they do that, they don't understand why black and brown people are not staying or why they're not coming. Or they do come and then they leave very quickly. They're like, what are we doing wrong? So they have all the things in the right spot, but they don't actually understand. They have the toolbox, but they don't actually know how to use the tools. So I am there to teach them how to use the tools and to better understand in cultural context and, just the thought of how to interact with those tools, the nuances, how to understand what it means to have policy that is inclusive. It's one thing to write it. It's one thing to another thing to act it out and to believe in it. So that's what I do from community groups, book clubs, soccer mom clubs, like all of that, all the way up to CEOs and the board of directors and all of that through anybody. I'm trying to think of people who I haven't worked with.
What's perhaps a problem with which you've been presented that you look at it and you go, here, try this or try that?
Well, it's really like this. It depends on, because I do several different things, it really depends on what, like you're saying, what you hired me to do. If you're talking to me about a book club, I have, every group I work with has a different perception of what they believe the problem is. That's first. I have several different types of curriculum that I do, but really what it is actually based in is subject matter. And I assess each group that I work with, like literally every single group that I work with, I assess where they are in terms of understanding race dynamics. So if I walk into a group and it's a board of directors that are all white women, and we're having a conversation and they're like, I have read every single book on anti-racism and equality and women's rights and black women and blah, 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 blah. We're into it. Like, we're super into it. I'm like, okay, great. So let's have this conversation about white supremacist culture. And then I assess that they are what I like to, in my mind, say theoretical anti-racist, where they have the words, they have the ideas of what it should look like, but they really don't embody it. So at that point, I bring it down from their vocabulary into real life situations. Now, Let's go to another board. And this is an actual situation where I go to a board of directors and they are very staunch on the idea that this is not really necessary. That matter of fact, that there's only two, now this is a quote, there's only 2% of Black people in Oregon, so what does it matter anyway, right? So, and that quote being from a place that's dealing with a population that their morbidity rate is almost 80% higher than white counterparts, even in that 2 to 3% that we have in Oregon. And what they serve is actually like killing the people they really don't care about. So it's really, it was very mind blowing for me. But that position that I have to take with them is not going to be the same as the people who are like, I've read all the books, now I'm ready to go down, like, let me know. Then I have to go with these people that are staunchly racist and then talk to them about recognizing racism. Like, do they see themselves as racist? What do they believe the barriers are? If they don't believe that 2 to 3% Black people are necessary, that's not a big enough percentage to give a damn about, that they should just keep doing what they're doing, and they're hiring me to teach them about anti-racism, I have to back that up. They're not going to get the same lesson plan as the other people, right? So each group that I work with gets a different lesson plan. What I do is I have people journal about experiences that they recognize as white supremacy after we've discussed what it looks like, this white supremacist culture. Once we can start to get on the ground of like, yes, I was actually going to the store and I realized that, you know, I'm just trying to make something up really quick. I had a hoodie on, I had my sunglasses on, I had a mask, and I had a giant purse. And I was walking through, and I was just kind of standing around. And nobody even asked what I was up to. Nobody bothered me. Nobody, you know, these kind of moments of privilege that they didn't think about until we start talking about the differences in relational differences for Black and brown people. And so every group is different. Every exercise I give them is catered to the group. We do journaling. I give workbook assignments. I give reading suggestions. So every group is a conversation, and we're able to let the group organically kind of develop from there. So that's what I do. It's very, very popular. People really, really like the approach. And it's just like I said, I'm not trying to convince anyone. You don't need to get an A on a quiz by the time I leave. It really is about, by the time I leave working with you, there is something that has shifted in the narrative around how to relate to Black and brown people, and how really what it is how white people can relate to themselves. What they really feel about racism is the point that I'm trying to drive, is that this in order to make create an anti-racist culture, white people have to get comfortable with how they feel about race. And that is generally not the center of the conversation. And that's what I do in my conversations.
In light of people actually talking about these issues, and in light of a lot of more publicized either police shootings or racist events or whatever that clearly have been going on for a long time, but now forever, certainly as long as our nation has been here, if not way beyond. In light of that, and in light of the fact of Black Lives Matter and movements and cases that are coming to light, as it were, do you feel like things are changing? Are you optimistic that these conversations being more open are helping? Or are you feeling like, look, this has been going on a long time and I'm not sure things are changing? Where are you with that?
Oh, well, you know, to be very frank, I've not ever in my lifetime, and both my parents are still alive and well, and I can't say even in their lifetime, because we talk about this very much as a family, that we've had this many white people engaged in the conversation. So something's changing for sure. The pandemic is awful, and 2020 could have just been skipped, right? But at the same time, 2020 gave us this gift of a pause. And in that moment, we got to see the truth And once you start to, like, it's kind of like the Pandora's box is cracking. And I think people, anybody who had their eyes open and their ears open, there's so much going on. There's so much transformation. And for me, I feel like there's more white folks who are at the conversation than there were before in a different way. Like, there's a way that white folks are showing up that's kind of like, sorry, I'm late to the party. I heard. I wasn't there. I feel a way about that. Can I please have a seat in the room? That is different than the approach before. Now, that doesn't say that there isn't plenty of the other, because that is swelling up as well. But I tend to focus on process and progress. And so I know that there's more white folks willing to look at the process. I feel like there's probably an increase in people who are willing to go through the process, but I'm very, very much like, you know, I need more evidence before I give you an A. Like, I'm the hard teacher, right? I'm not a mean teacher, but I'm just kind of like, okay, that sounds really wonderful. Let's talk about it some more. I want to make sure that I want you to tell me about what you're thinking about, and then we're going to talk more about it. And so the more I get people that I'm working with who contact me after I work with them, because that's a benefit that I have, is like, once we've worked together, you can always contact me to continue the conversation. So they contact me and they're saying, you know, I'd like to talk to you about this incident that happened to me. Am I reading that right? And I'm saying, bravo in that moment, because you stopped yourself. You noticed something. You decided to act differently than you would have acted before, would have behaved before. And not only did you stop yourself, you questioned the other things around you that came to that point. Now we're talking about processing. Now we're getting somewhere. That, to me, is happening more and more. I don't know that that's the approach for everybody. That's the approach that I'm giving to the work. And I find that my approach is bringing out real thought process and real moments of relational discovery to inner racism, inner implicit biases that is trying to make that less scary. So I feel like that is progress, right? There's more people that are looking for those services. But I want to say at the same time, don't get me wrong, I have plenty of people who the city will assume is very, very open and inclusive because of the work that they do. And I can tell you that those folks believe that because the system is working the way it is, most people believe that we're inclusive, that should be good enough. Not that I actually have to be inclusive. Not that I have to believe that that is important, as long as it's set up that it is. That is super problematic. And I get almost the same amount of that as I get of people who are wanting to show up and be like, really actually do the work, slow down their processes, look at their policies, change their policies. Board of directors who are saying, we're not doing this right. We got to go back to our, you know, to our policies and to our bylaws and look at where the barriers are. It's about 50-50, but I think that's change. I think that's progress. So anyway, that's where I'm at. I'm very optimistic, and that's the kind of person I am. I don't believe in the punitive idea. I'm very protective of my energy. I truly believe that people have their own journey through this work. Some people go flying through it and really catch on quickly and absorb it wholeheartedly. Other people have a harder time. Doesn't mean either one is better or not. As long as you're on the journey, I'm here for it.
Thank you for the work you do and for talking here today. And is there anything you want to add before we go?
Oh, yeah. I would love to say that I really want to encourage everyone to have conversations that are for themselves and to themselves about the work that they're doing. Really get authentic about your approach to this work. And I guess my whole goal, and I hope that in my work as I spread it through the United States and beyond, is more of an alignment of heart and mind and relationship to what we've been taught as a collective. And just understand that the deconstruction of white supremacist culture is difficult, And the deconstruction of white supremacist culture is different for BIPOC people and for white people, but the work is still there. BIPOC people are deconstructing white supremacist culture, and so are white people. The work is just different. So try to approach each other with kindness. It's thick out here, you know, it's lots of prickly stuff going on. So let's just see that we are in a space of transformation for everyone and just be respectful of each other's journeys. That would be the last thing I have to say about that.
Thank you so much for your time and your insight and your work. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me.
You've been listening to KLCC Media's The Oregon Grapevine, fresh pressed conversations with people who are actively and passionately creating the present and future in which they wish to live.